I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Ruthie's Table 4 in partnership with Montclair. Last night, Emily Mortimer came to Thanksgiving dinner with her family at our home. And as is a tradition, at the end of the meal, we all sang You Are My Sunshine, our favorite family song. Looking down at the table of 40 people, our eyes met and stayed there for all four verses. In those moments, memories flooded back of the girl I knew since she was six, the time we spent with her father, John, playwright and barrister, and her mother, Penny, fly fisher and tennis player who managed the no small feat of smoking while playing the game. What Emily does now is impressive. She's an actor, a writer, director, Notting Hill, The Pursuit of Love, Newsroom, Matchpoint, The New Look, An Apple Show with Juliette Binoche, and Paddington 3. When I see Emily, our conversation is mostly about what she did rather than what she's doing. For she was one of the first employees of the River Cafe in 1989, when being 17 and totally inexperienced was no obstacle to being a waiter. Here in the River Cafe today, we're going to talk about food and memories. For she is my family, and most of all, Emily Mortimer. You are my sunshine.
Oh, Ruthie, oh my goodness. You are. I'm so cry before I even begin.
That was so nice to see you.
Back in the fold.
I know, fully.
Yeah, you're fully back. Fashion. We're going to get you back in here. But do you remember what it felt like or what it was like?
Yes, I do. It was just the same. It was just smaller. I mean, was it like half the size
of
this?
This was the kitchen. We had a bar going across here.
Yes, that's right. The bar was here. I definitely remember
that bar was a wall.
The kitchen was this end. Yeah, I can remember that very clearly. But there were tables outside sometimes in the summer.
Yeah.
And we all do you still get them, do the waitresses and the waiters do the prep?
Yeah, that was
the most amazing
that we've really kept in the mornings.
I mean, that really is what taught me to cook, I think, is coming here and having to like grate parmesan and sweat the peppers and all that kind of thing. Peel the peppers, you know, and get the food ready, and then you kind of are part of it, which is just such a cool thing.
So we'll start with the recipe that you chose, which was a pear and almond tart. Pear and almond tart serves 10 to 12. 6 ripe Comice pears, 350 grams of blanched whole almonds, 350 grams of unsalted butter, softened, 350 grams of caster sugar, 3 eggs. Peel, half, and core the pears. Place the pear halves face down and in one layer in a pre-baked sweet pastry base. Put the almonds in a food processor and chop until fine. Cream together the butter and sugar with an electric mixer until pale and light. Add the almonds, then the eggs, one by one. Pour this almond mixture over the pears. Bake for 40 minutes or until the filling is golden brown and set. Leave to cool and serve with a dollop of creme fraiche. We do a version of the pear and almond tart all year. So in the summer we make a tart with raspberries, with the almond frangipane, don't we, or the strawberries. Yeah. But I do think, for me, the best is pear combination.
It's a classic.
Yeah.
Well, I just love it because it's the sort of most amazing bang for your buck of a pudding, because people can't believe that a human mortal made it and you didn't just buy it in a sort of...
Yeah,
you know, boulangerie or something. It really does, and it's so simple and easy, as all your recipes are, but it just is so sort of delicious and really impressive. People are always just like, did you really make this? Aww. Did you make the pastry? And you're like, yeah.
Sean, would you do the pastry?
Yeah, the pastry is 375 grams of plain flour, 250 grams of unsalted butter, which you pulse in a RoboCoupe or Magimix kind of machine, then add 100 grams of icing sugar, give that a little pulse, then bind it together with 3 egg yolks, and it will make a firm dough that you need to refrigerate for a couple of hours. And then the secret of the almond tart is that we actually grate the dough into the, using a thick cheese grater, isn't it? And then grate that into the pastry tin and press it out. Don't try and roll it because you'll probably never
have a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, exactly. The secrets of our recipes. Press it into place. You can make it as thick or as thin as you like, but as long as you pre-bake it before you put the almonds in, isn't it?
Yes.
Put the cake mixture in. It's probably one of the desserts that's been on since for how many, 35 years now? Yeah. 36
oh my
years?
Gosh. 35 years, I can't believe that. I haven't actually done the maths on purpose.
So let's carry on back to those early, early days and to being a waiter here. What, you were 17?
Yeah, I was 17.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah. And what, do you remember the story of why you came or what happened?
I was trying to make a bit of money on my summer after
your gap year?
Well, yes, it was the beginning of my gap year, and it was really the beginning of my life, because I was a very, very shy, believe it or not, child, and still am as a person. And actually, cooking, I have found in my life, has been something, there's been the greatest sort of way of counteracting being shy, because you can sort of have people over and have parties and friends, but you can sort of also be hiding behind this thing. And I think coming and being a waitress was really the first time that I had sort of been in life. Like, I knew I was going to go to university, and I knew I was going to go to Russia before I went to university, having never really kissed a boy hardly, having never really kind of hardly got drunk, having really lived a very secluded life. And this was my sort of gateway to the beginning of my life, coming here. And I think my parents had just said, you need to make a bit of money, and why don't you be a waitress? And they probably just asked you, and you very kindly had agreed to have this completely callow, sort of just demented child.
I'll change the adjective to have this absolutely fabulously beautiful, charming, open. I think shyness is a really interesting conversation, because I was at a dinner the other night and I said to somebody that I stood outside the door. I hadn't been to like a big dinner party for a long time, and it was for Graydon Carter, and I said I kind of stood outside really not wanting to ring that doorbell, go into a room of a whole lot of people. And he said, well, I was at that doorstep too, because I didn't want to go into a room. And there are people who they just assume that you're not shy,
or
that things don't bother you, when in fact there is that terror. And I sometimes do that, of heading into the kitchen to talk
to
the
people. Yes, it's a safe place.
Because I think, oh, Ruthie Rogers is here, so you know, I'm really interested to talk. But you just feel safe, don't you, when you're in the kitchen.
And you can hide behind the business of getting something ready, and you don't actually have to sort of properly be dealing with the sort of responsibility of talking.
Well, Trump told me that when she has a dinner party, you keep your apron on so you don't have to talk to people.
Thanks for divulging that. I find that if I wear my chef's outfit, I'm more confident than if I was in my normal clothes. And when I was trying to buy my car, I was
You went with your chef's
suit. No, I was doing the deal when I had my chef's outfit on, because I was much more like assertive.
Tough.
Yeah, I was like in the role.
I can totally imagine that. I think
superhero.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't need psychiatrists anymore.
We just need
psychologists. We'll just send you a chef's outfit.
I think we should all have a chef's outfit.
We'll give you one to take home today.
Please.
There's a natural barrier. Like, if I have to talk to people, if I'm like, people come to my house, I keep my apron on. It keeps me in the persona.
Totally.
Otherwise, I'm like really nervy.
Well, it's funny though, also I was thinking about last night and coming to your incredible dinner, and just thinking it's and as is coming to your restaurant, it's like you're entering this world, and in a funny way it feels like, because people think as an actor you're not shy because you're performing all the time and you're putting yourself out there, but as I said, that's really the only way I can exist is by forcing myself into this. But it's like putting on a show in a way, like having a dinner, or having it's putting it's or you know, having a restaurant or whatever, but even having people for dinner in your own home, I always feel like that. It's, you make it look nice and you sort of put the music on then and you sort of light the fire and you can create this kind of world that people...
A stage set,
but it is all a kind of illusion, and really the sort of behind the scenes, you're sort of going, you know, you're doing like, and shouting at everybody to tidy their bedrooms, and anyway, so I feel very, I think coming to as a young,
coming
to this magical place, it felt like, it felt the best way of sort of forcing myself into life because it was. You and your family and Rose and just, it was a family.
1989, we opened in September 87. Did we teach you anything?
Yes, and you what taught me, you learn? Basically taught me how to cook. You taught me. Yeah.
But that's even more scary. We opened a restaurant, the 17-year-old was in the kitchen cooking, yeah.
No, you didn't, I wasn't cooking, but I was grating.
Yeah, you,
Fashi was saying, they still do that here, that the waiters, that you really become very familiar with the food and you're making it, and you have to get in earlier than most waiters would come to do a job in a restaurant, so you get in a few hours before and you grate the parmesan, or you a lot of the time was chopping up the basil and the parsley and things like that, and just sort of becoming. And I can always remember you saying, and my mum says that to me, Ruthie always says, and I said I can remember her saying it, just get a good smell going. Oh. You know, and that's true. I always think of that as I'm cooking now. Just like, you know, it's going to be okay if it's, you've just got this good smell going. And then,
but what about being a waiter? Who taught you how to wait?
No one, and no I still am.
That's training. That's the training at the River Cafe.
I mean, yeah, I really was.
What was the story
was
about the nemesis? What was that story about the nemesis and the glass?
You said
you broke a glass over a nemesis, a whole nemesis.
I'm sure I did. I mean, I broke everything over everything. I was. I just remember the dry cleaning bills that you guys were having to pay on my behalf to people that had red wine dropped in their laps. And I've come to the conclusion that actually being a waiter is a very difficult job.
Yeah.
And people don't really...
Make you be nicer to waiters when you go to a restaurant?
Yes. There's so much going on in your head at one time where you really are having to try to remember. And you could generally, you can get from starter to main course. That's okay. You can remember because you can see you've taken their plates away. But then you take the main course plates away and then you just forget about them for hours because then you just forget totally to bring them their pudding menus. Or, and then once they've had their pudding, you're just like, you totally forget.
You don't have to pay a bill.
No,
don't worry about the bill.
That was always the bit that undid me, was remembering. But then I was remembering the other day, there was this awful thing where I still feel guilty about this man called, I mean, I think his name was Dougal McDougal, and he was eating his lunch here, and there was a big Christmas lunch, and everybody was going bananas, getting ready for, you know, the service, and then this lunch full of people, and it was a Christmas thing, and so all the people from all the offices were having their Christmas lunches, and the phone was going off the hook, bananas, this phone kept ringing, and no one had time to pick it up.
That's when we had the phone in the restaurant. And people picked it up and took a reservation, yeah.
And I remember finally picking it up and thinking, because I thought maybe this is something, you know, I need to, you know, somebody needs to deal with this phone. And I picked it up and I said hello, and the woman said, oh, hello, you know, you've got a Mr. Dougal McDougal dining with you today, and he's urgently required to the telephone. And I said, oh, yes, absolutely, I'll find him for you. And I put the phone down and I thought, how do I find Dougal McDougal and all these people? And then I looked around and I saw this man and I just thought, I think you're Dougal McDougal. And he was so sweet looking. He had a sort of mullet hairdo and then a suit that was slightly ill-fitting, but he looked really lovely. And anyway, I just thought, you're Dougal McDougal. I think you are. And I went over and I said, are you by any chance Mr. Dougal McDougal? And the man said, yes, I am. And I was so victorious, and I went to the phone and I picked up the phone and I said, he's just coming. And he went and all lunch long, and he had his phone call and it was all good. All lunch long, I was just so happy and laughing about this story to myself, and it got me through the lunch. And then at the end of lunch, I started telling all the other staff and the waitresses and the chefs and all about it. And everybody was laughing uproariously. And I said, and I saw this man and I just knew out of everybody in this restaurant full of people that had to be Dougal McDougal. Sure enough, it was. And I described his mullet and his badly fitting suit. And then this little voice went, I'm still here, you know. And it was Dougal McDougal. And he'd gone to the loo while I was telling the story and come out and heard me. And I still, to this day, wake up in the night just feeling bad.
Well, Dougal McDougal, if you're listening to this podcast,
I have a big apology to make. I really feel bad.
The other night, when you had somebody came up to me, this man came up at the pass, and he said, my wife is dying to meet you. I said, okay. So I went over, and I said, I hear you're dying to meet me. And it was the wrong table. I'm not dying to meet you.
We're just trying to have our dinner.
Coming to my table and say you're dying to meet me. So things, you know, it was 35 years later, it's still
chaotic. But I remember the other thing I remember was that cell phones had only just started, and people were they had phones in their cars, and they were some of these men, these sort of guys that were trying to show off and be fancy, would go to the car park and phone in their pudding orders from the car park to show off about their phones.
We once had somebody, was using their cell phone outside, and a waiter went up and for some reason said, you know, we'd prefer you not to use your cell phone. It's disturbing other people. She said, well, I was trying to get the attention of a waiter. She was actually calling reception to ask a waiter to come to her table. So, yeah, being a waiter is hard. It really is hard.
It requires an awful lot of concentration, and your brain has to be in about 25 places at once.
Did you ever work anywhere else?
No, of course not. I mean, I was unemployable as a waitress at home. It would be good to try it one more time. I should
come back here.
Service.
Don't you? Yeah, we get you back here to do it. Did you know the River Cafe has a shop? It's full of our favorite foods and designs. We have cookbooks, linen napkins, kitchenware, tote bags with our signatures, glasses from Venice, chocolates from Turin. You can find us right next door to the River Cafe in London or online at shoptherivercafe.co.uk. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Help helps is a maxim I believe in. We all carry around stress and hardship, and when we keep it inside, it starts to chip away. Therapy is a safe place, and therapy is for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie. BetterHelp.com/Ruthie.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Going back to before you were 17, so let's talk about growing up in the Mortimer household and food. What were meals like at your house?
Well, Dad could really cook and loved food, but he always said his favorite, his idea of good food is food you don't really need teeth to eat, like sort of mashed potato or kedgeree was his favorite thing, a sort of comfort food. And I remember as a little girl, my dad always cooked me boiled eggs and toast soldiers. That was the thing. I used to say, get my eggs, you bugger. Yeah. Come down in the morning and send them back if they weren't. I mean, I was
That's
a very
she
shy.
Said. She said that to me.
I was
she
a very shy child, food. But I was not shy with my dad. And so I would, yeah, I would send back the eggs if they weren't exactly cooked to my you know, certain specificity. And if the toast soldiers weren't perfectly lightly blundered, I was very, you know, annoyed. But food, I mean, our family was such a sort of place of love, and also, as all families, quite dysfunctional in lots of wonderful ways. But the one thing that they really always got right, my mum and dad, was meals. Like, we always, I can't remember not having, I mean, we just always ate together, whether it was at you know, dinner at home with mum normally cooking, or sometimes dad, or in a restaurant. And restaurants are from our dad. Both me and Rosie, my sister, have inherited just a love of restaurants. And his attitude to restaurants was that it was just sort of, that there was no problem so great or sort of heart so broken that it couldn't be slightly made better by a delicious meal in a restaurant with a white tablecloth and preferably a glass or three of champagne. Yeah. And that there was something so cheering about going out for lunch or dinner in a nice restaurant. And I think Rosie and I just still have that. We're addicted to restaurants.
Right. Are you?
It just feels like such a treat. It never stops being a treat. And just sort of that feeling of being cozy and with people you love in this kind of special place. And again, another thing of that, of wherever you are in the world, finding a little key into it's a way of getting to know people and getting to know the place you're in and finding some sort of, you know, place that feels authentic to where you are and being there. Generally, you're with people you really like, eating good food. And
it tells you about the culture you're in,
totally.
And the place you are. Did you, because I always think of your parents as being incredibly social as well. You know,
they were very
your
social.
Your father was this, you know, playwright and his, you know, voyage around my father, and he was defending Oz magazine. The Oz trial.
Yeah. And the Sex Pistols.
You know, he's a really radical lawyer who was, you know, on the forefront of every case that was happening, or everything that was contentious. There was John Mortimer, and yet such a gentle and gorgeous man. And Penny, I say the first time I met Penny, she was sitting on his lap, you know, and I think, you know, it was just, they were such a kind of important people in our lives. And so they were able to have this life of going out or people entertaining, and you still felt very part of that.
Yes, yeah. Very much part of it. And we were always... I mean, Dad loved young people and children, and he just thought children were sort of, you know, the best type of people. And and he was always so sympathetic about being a young person. He said, it's just like, life will never be as hard as it is when you're young. Mm. And school is awful, and it's just like, so these terrible hours, unpaid labor, and, you know, given terrible food at lunchtime, he was very just completely sympathetic to the plight of and the loneliness of childhood. So he was very inclusive, and lunches and dinners or whatever it was always like we were never sort of expected not to be part of it. And so I really think no matter sort of how much life is falling apart at the seams, which it always is, of course, like if you can manage to kind of corral, you know, the people that you love and together for lunch or dinner or whatever it is, it just does make a difference. It just feels really comforting to me to be sitting around a table with people, and because that was the part of life that I think really was functioning, you know, when I was little. It was really nice.
And when you left this joyous home of being sitting around the table and you went to Oxford.
Yes.
Oh, no, you went to Russia first.
I went to Russia on my gap year.
And did you manage to find a home that was like that in Russia, or were you sort of in the middle of nowhere?
I was in Moscow, and I do remember eating there a lot. I can remember the food very well, and there was always... I mean, I love Russian food because probably I associate it with that time, but that's quite sort of stodgy, like sort of pelmeny little dumplings with cream but also lots of dill. They put dill on everything, and I still cook lots with dill. Somehow that really kind of brings me back to being there. And then I remember I cooked my first and last goose in Moscow.
Did you?
accurate.
I went to a market to buy, because I was going to try and cook a roast chicken. And then I went to the market and they didn't have any chicken, but they did have a goose. So I called up my mum. It was very difficult to get through. You couldn't really make phone calls back and forth to England.
What
at
year
that
was
time.
That?
1989, 1990, wow. So it was probably 90 yeah. then. And I had to go to this hotel and pay with a credit card for my phone call that, you know, cost about sort of £50 to sort of have a 5-minute phone call back to England. And I remember mum looking up the recipe for a goose. She kept saying, a goose is very different from a chicken, darling. Yeah. Anyway, I remember spending just all day long with this goose. And I remember putting it into the oven, and because it was like you had to take the wings off and the breasts off and then prick it and primp it, and I don't really remember, but I can remember putting the goose in the oven saying, I'm so sorry, I feel like I've really got to know you so well over this time. I feel terrible.
It's quite intimate. Yeah, intimacy and cooking.
And then you went to Oxford. Did you care about that you didn't eat well in Oxford, or did you eat well in Oxford? Did your parents rescue you from...
I can't really... I went to Lincoln College, which was famous for its food, but I don't really remember eating much. I think I just went to lots of parties and slept and didn't do anything apart from plays. Yeah. I didn't really cook there, no. I did...
Would you go home for family meals?
Yeah, I'd go home because I could drive back home. It was about a 45-minute drive. Back home, and so I'd go home at the weekends and things and take my washing and get a good Sunday lunch. Sunday lunch is something I really sort of remember from that time of my life, because, I mean, and then when I was in my late 20s, I moved to America where they don't really have Sunday lunch. But the sort of smell of Sunday lunch cooking and my dad listening to the radio and Radio 4 and the sort of the smell of something delicious sort of cooking, you know, is something that I really miss. And coming back here when it happens, I'm just sort of immediately just feel full of sort of nostalgia and happiness.
But now that you're mother of two, do you replicate any of those traditions?
Yeah, I do. I do. I mean, I do like a sort of roast, whatever.
You do have Sunday lunch.
Yes, I do. But it's hard to keep up that tradition when the culture isn't doing
it. They have brunch.
Yeah, brunch is a whole thing, which I never really know what to do for brunch. If you had to cook a brunch, what would you do?
I think probably I'd go and get bagels and cream cheese, and isn't that what they eat?
Yeah.
I find that going out to lunch in New York on a Sunday is really challenging because you can't have lunch. It's a brunch.
No.
So it's kind of... By that time, it's 12, and you maybe have had something in the breakfast, and then it's breakfast all over again. I think they say it's lunch, but it is really pretty breakfasty, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically glorified breakfast.
Yeah, I know.
And then I panic because I feel like I've got to... I don't really know how to do a brunch, so I sort of I go really over the top, and then it's like sort of brunch at the Four Seasons or something. Yeah. Just like quiches, and there's just too much. But, Sunday lunch is... But you have to... If you do a Sunday lunch in America, you have to sort of make a thing of it, because people don't really carve out that time on a Sunday to just sit around doing nothing. And like,
do you think it is a really different culture of eating in Brooklyn and London in terms of going? Do people go out much more?
Yeah,
it's starting here too now. I think, you know, I think there. Do you go out to people's houses for meals, or do you mostly go to restaurants?
I go to people's houses.
Yeah.
Probably more now. I'm older than I used to, I think. I was talking about it with one of the young chefs today, and he was saying he'd gone to eat in another one of the chef's house, and they felt really grown up. Because he was saying most times you'd go to the pub or go out to a restaurant, whereas now they're starting to go to people's houses because people are starting to get houses.
Right.
You know, I think maybe it kind of times in with... when you have a property or something, or somewhere big enough to host.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I always like a home. You know, I love when I go to a foreign city and eat at home.
Yeah.
You know, because as you say, that kind of, what you were saying before about certain restaurants, but it does tell you about the culture, doesn't it?
Yes, totally.
It tells you about how people are, and you sit around, and it's nice.
There's so much in a cooked meal from somebody that, you know, that at home, because their whole...
their whole history and all their culture and all their everything is in, baked into whatever it is you're eating in the most kind of, it's so specific, like it's just like, it's like somebody's handwriting or something that, you know, it's like everything about their history and the history of their lives and culture and everything is somehow in whatever this dish is.
Yeah.
And it's, no, it's just so nice and just, yeah.
We had I think I've told this before, but we were in Prague and Richard had an honorary degree and we were walking around, we couldn't find a restaurant and we just stopped somebody and said, can you tell us, you know, where would be a good restaurant to eat? And then she talked and then she'd been to Richard's lecture, so she invited us to her house the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And we went. On the way there, I was going, oh, you know, we're going to somebody's house that we don't know. And it was so touching because they'd gotten out all the family linen and she made all these Czech, you know, specialties. And it's something that's really stuck in my mind about how nice it was to...
Well, yeah, that always happens in Russia, actually, in Moscow. You know, you would go to people's houses and they'd invite you for dinner and it would be this whole thing that would last the whole day long. And they'd generally living in tiny apartments, you know, on the outskirts of the city, but they would put, like... they'd make a table out of sort of a bit of, you know, wood and put some chairs together and make this table in the middle of the only sort of living space. And it would be just this feast and all these crazy mismatched things, but just like dish upon dish upon dish and sort of just so special. And you feel so, you know, it's such an act of love in that way. It is, yeah.
If you like listening to Ruthie's Table 4, would you please make sure to rate and review the podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
We mentioned all the work you are doing, not that you did. Tell us about how you either write, direct, or act with food. I mean, so...
Food is so... food really is something that I just find to be one of the things that cheers me up most in life. So even if it's bad food, I don't mind what it is. So I get on a film set, you generally get very bad food, but... Even that, I just look forward to it so much. Lunch, you know, and I still can't quite believe I'm being given a free hot lunch, you know, and it just is that little, and generally what's happened now, which I hate, is that they've got much more into these continuous days where you just sort of eat on the run, you know, you're given 10 minutes to sort of do it, and it does mean that everybody goes home earlier, so... Mm. Instead of a 12-hour...
Is that called the French style or something? Somebody said that was a sort of French method where, you know, you keep working and working.
You keep working through. Yeah. I really miss that thing of just being... Because, again, it's like the food bit of the day, the lunch, is a time to kind of recover. Mm. You know, just to... It's like
is
a rest.
When you're acting.
When you're acting and you need... I really think you need an hour to just sit there and eat your sort of generally not very good sort of cabbage and... I don't know, whatever, sausage or something. But just it's still a treat. And you kind of just feel like, oh, I've just got this little moment to sit and think about what happened this morning and or just zone out and then just kind of then gradually get ready for the next half of the day. And I do feel like that little breaks in life, it's like little holidays from life that meals can give you. And on a film set, that's just definitely true. And it's part of the social life of being on set. and as such is really an important focus for the day. So I love catering, whether, as I said, whether or not it's good or bad. I just love the fact of it on film sets. And then
as a director,
that's harder because you are so overwhelmed with all these different millions of things that you've, plates you've got spinning and questions you've got to answer, that you can't really afford the time to sit and sort of chat and have your lunch. So that wasn't really a big part of the day for me when I was directing. And then writing is such a solitary thing. But I found that I can only really now write. I think I must have some kind of sort of undiagnosed ism where I can't write unless I'm in a very loud, busy, like I would be able to write brilliantly in the River Cafe. But I have to, so there's a cafe on the end of my block, a kind of restaurant that's open all day long in Brooklyn, and I go there and I sit there literally for hours at a time, and I it's quite good because I generally a lot of, I think I like the kind of buzz of noise. And I kind of feel like that's the only way I can sort of do it. Whereas if I sit at home, I just get very sleepy and fall asleep. And
do you eat, though, at the cafe? Do they bring
And then
you
I
food?
Eat, and then I have my little sort of salad or a little bowl of pasta at lunchtime, and that's my break.
Yeah. You know, Christopher Hampton, I think it might have been Les Liaisons Dangereuses, I can't remember, but certainly when we opened, I think he was a friend of Rose, and he would come with, I don't even think, of our computers in 1989, so he probably just came with a pad and hand wrote it, and he would sit there and write. You know, it's just, and there are people who come and work. Rue, my son, he really likes to work in a cafe, and Richard used to like working. We had countless studies in the house, or places where you could be quiet and work, and he would always choose the kitchen table or where the kids were
the noisiest
coming
bit.
In. Yeah, it's interesting about how different people work around. Do you think about what you're going to eat the next day when you're going to bed? Do you sometimes think, what will I have for lunch tomorrow? Or do you think about it when you wake up?
I sometimes sort of, not really. I mean, I guess I think about what I might buy to cook for people. Mm-hmm. But no, my dad was a great one for that. Like, we had to basically have decided what we were eating in the car on the way to any restaurant. Yeah, I think because it was so funny, he definitely had lots of undiagnosed isms. It was like lots of sort of anxiety. So around, you know, he loved restaurants, but we had to be in and out. And when he got very irritated if anyone ordered pudding. But and we all had to have worked out what we were going to have before we sat down, you know. So,
So you would go back to the same restaurant over and over again. Yeah. What was it?
He loved the Woolsey.
He loved the Woolsey, yeah.
Or here.
And so he knew the menu and he'd go back.
Yeah, I get that. But Richard, I was just, as you said, Richard, I just do feel like that memory of him with that kind of beaming... Yeah. Grin yeah. in yeah. here, and no matter how many glasses of Nebbiola I was spilling, or Dougal McDougal's I was sort of being mean to, there was just this feeling of this just kind sort of Cheshire cat there that just made everything, it didn't matter, you know.
Well, you were, I will not have it said that you were the worst waitress at the River Cafe. Sometimes we introduce Emily says I'm the worst waitress, or somebody said, was Emily the worst waitress? I'd say you were right up there on the top, right? That, all the qualities she's talking about is something we'd look for in a waiter, wouldn't it?
I do remember just feeling so, it was just so sort of, I know glamorous probably isn't the right word, but that's what I don't know, just sort of full of sort of magic. And you felt all these magical people would come, like, do you remember, of course you remember, but Adam Alvarez used to come with the truffles.
Yeah.
And just the most handsome man on earth, just like this truffle man who would come with having got all these truffles from wherever, was it Alba or I don't know, in Italy. And you're just like, oh my gosh, who are these people? This collection of amazing characters that are attracted to you and your world and are part of it all. And it just was, it felt a little bit like sort of Alice and falling down the rabbit hole, just ending up in this, it really is, you know, magic.
Yeah. So tell us what you're working on now, Emily Mortimer.
Well, so, Ruthie Rogers, Ruthie I am Rogers. Making, I came to do Paddington 3.
Yeah.
And I shot that here in London. I was so happy to come back and be here for a long period and work on that incredible franchise.
Beautiful. It's a great.
It's really amazing. Great. And
especially now in these times.
Yes, you know, there's something about like, look, please look after this bear. Feels even more important than it ever did. And I felt so grateful to be a part of that and to be able to bring my family, my little American family, here for a while and be in London. And then more and more I seem to find myself writing and directing and being more less in front of the camera, more behind it, which I'm really enjoying. I love it so much. And I guess part of it is being this shy person, but that I both wanted to have attention on me and perform and everything in a way, and then also just was sort of terrified and horrified by it, and it made me quite sort of neurotic. And I find writing and directing much less so. It's just all about telling a story, which acting is too. And when it's at its best, acting isn't about how pretty you are, how clever you are, how funny you are, all these silly things that don't mean anything. But you do get quite distracted by all that.
So what is the writing and directing you're doing?
Oh, so I have written this film with Noah Baumbach, who's also a great fan of the River Cafe and of yours. Mm. And that's being shot here in the spring. And that was amazing. And I learned so much from him, obviously. And then I'm writing a film of my own to direct, hopefully, about my time in Russia, actually. And yeah, so I feel I'm enjoying this bit of my creative life in a way that is different from how it was before. It feels just good. Fun.
Good. and going back to the food, you might shoot in Italy?
Noah's movie, we're definitely shooting half in London and half in Italy. Yeah. In Tuscany.
Does that excite you when you make a film in another country to think about the food of that country?
Totally. I mean, it's going to be amazing. I mean, it will be because he's a real foodie.
Yeah.
And he loves Italian food too, and so there's no doubt that food on that film will be amazing. No, that'll be so nice. You've got to come.
We're coming.
I think you're going to be in it, Ruthie.
We're going to be in it.
Yeah. I think he wants you to be in it. I think he's convinced you.
He hasn't seen me in film. I don't think we can put me in.
It'll be a cameo.
That's the thing.
It'll be a cameo.
The last.
So your quid pro quo.
Exactly.
The last compliment I had was over food in New York. I had dinner with this couple. And apparently we had such a good time. They went back to California. They were both screenwriters and actors or whatever. And they bought a dog and named it after me.
No! Oh my goodness, that's the highest compliment.
They called their dog Ruby. So I could either be in a film or I could have a dog named after me.
What kind of a dog was it?
I don't know, because I'm not a huge dog person. So funny. You said, and I thought maybe something like that was coming. They're going to put you in a movie, or right? They liked you so much, they named your dog. So our very, very last question, which we do, is to say if food is love and food is, traveling and food is your memories of your parents. And I remember those Sunday lunches at Turville Heath where there was cricket and food and sitting and children running around. And I remember all the meals I had with your family and a great meal I had with you last week and back to Thanksgiving. So food is all that. It also is comfort. And so I hope you don't need comfort very often. If you do, call me. But if you don't want to call, is there a food that you would go to for comfort?
Well, for some reason, it's so weird. It's ravioli.
Ravioli. Good. I get it.
I find ravioli just the most comforting food. Yeah. And whenever I'm asked what my favorite food is, I always say ravioli. And May's always saying, but you never have ravioli. Yeah. And I'm like, that's my daughter. She said, but that's such a lie. You don't have ravioli. And I'm like, I know, but I love ravioli. And if I were to feel really like I wanted to treat myself or I was feeling really sad, I'd order a plate of ravioli and it would make me feel. I don't think you could feel. And it's quite hard to make bad ravioli. I mean, of course it is. I guess it's quite easy probably. But I just think ravioli is delicious.
That thing of putting your fork in and the
something
mixture
oozing
in the
out.
Yeah. Sean made the most amazing. I hope we have ravioli. Do we have ravioli on the menu today?
We do.
Do we?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to.
What
have
are
it.
They? Which one are they?
They've got a mixture of greens in today and ricotta and pecorino. They're nice, I think.
Oh God, I'm definitely going to get that.
Even though you don't need comfort.
Well, it goes back to my dad. Food you don't really need teeth to eat.
Oh, that's
it's probably the best kind.
Okay, well, let's go have lunch. You can just thank you.
Suck on our
revenue. So nice. You're great.
Oh, I
thank
loved
you.
It. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Ruthie's Table 4 in partnership with Montclair.
Ruthie's Table 4 is produced by Atomai Studios for iHeartRadio. It's hosted by Ruthie Rogers and it's produced by Willa Malensky. This episode was edited by Julia Johnson and mixed by Nigel Appleton. Our executive producers are Faye Stewart and Zad Rogers. Our production manager is Caitlin Paramore and our production coordinator is Bella Cellini. This episode had additional contributions by Sean Wynn Owen. Thank you to everyone at the River Cafe for your help in making this episode.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.